Senator Nelson won't be here.
He is here.
Oh, he is.
Right there.
Oh. Okay, for the next one. Yep. Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It is April 5th and would like to start. We are going to start with Senate Bill 600 and then we are going to do Senate Bill 946. So we have some of our esteemed colleagues in the audience that would like to speak on both of these bills. And I think the first one will be pretty quick. So, Senator, can you hang out, Senator Nelson, for a little bit? Okay, great. So with that, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 600. Beth, if you can provide an overview.
Senate Bill 600 modifies provisions related to the lease or easements on submersible state lands, creates new exemptions from requirements for certain structures and work on state-owned submerged and submersible land. You should have in your packet both a -1 and a -2 amendment. We don't have fiscal impact statements yet, and there's no revenue impact.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the senator from District 16. And actually, my district is germane to this bill. If you close your eyes and picture my district, it bordered on one side by the Pacific Ocean and on the rest of it by the Columbia River. It doesn't come as any huge surprise that much of the land that exists in Senate District 16 is behind dikes, levees, and other water management structures. The genesis of this bill was a series of frankly fairly acrimonious hearings that occurred during DSL rule promulgation. Two different sides of the DSL House were up doing rules almost simultaneously. That's a little bit of an exaggeration. But my district was pretty frustrated and pretty undone by the rules. As a result of these hearings, Director Soliday and I decided that maybe we could put together a bill that addressed some of the concerns, and so I became the author of Senate Bill 600. The bill was drafted. Much of it was, or some of it was DSL. Some of it came, as you will hear in Director Soliday's testimony, from the public. So it's an amalgamation bill. There are two amendments. The dash ones came as a result of conversations that I had with many of the agricultural interests in my community that do routine ditch maintenance. The original draft of the bill had 50 cubic yards of material in it, and we have offered the dash one amendments that would allow agriculturalists to take out 100 cubic yards of material in routine ditch maintenance. I'm sure you will hear more about that from others behind me as I depart to go testify on another bill in another committee. I am very strongly supportive of the dash ones because part of animal husbandry includes the maintenance of ditches on agricultural property. Again, I want to use this forum to commend Dale Buck, a retired dairy farmer who you will hear from. Dale probably knows the DSL regs better than some of the DSL personnel, and he will share with you at length the value of the dash ones. The dash twos came as a result of a conversation that I think, and the director will correct me if I'm wrong, the Attorney General had with her expressing some concern about the Willamette Harbor cleanup, and I'm looking to make sure that's right, and she's nodding in affirmative. And so the dash twos were to make sure that we didn't get into trouble as the state was pursuing the Willamette cleanup. And I am very supportive of the dash ones, and I am very supportive of the dash twos. I commend this bill to your consideration. Is it a perfect bill? No. Is it a reflection of some agency concerns? Yes. Is it a reflection of some public concerns? Yes. Is the bill made better by the dash ones and twos? Yes. And I will leave the details to the others behind me. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I hope that the committee is favorably disposed to moving it forward.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions for the senator before we let her go off to her other pursuits? Okay.
Thank you very much.
So next we will hear from Director Soliday.
Good afternoon, committee members. Madam Chair, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands, here to testify on Senate Bill 600 with the dash two amendments. As Senator Johnson indicated, this bill comes out of some concerns that DSL staff had with some of the language that is in ORS 274, as well as some public concerns that were raised as we were out doing rulemaking on our waterway leasing program last year. And I want to just review the changes for you that are in this bill. Currently in statute, when we are leasing waterways, submerged submersible lands on waterways across the state, there is a preference right given to the upland landowner. So there's nothing on the waterway in front of an upland landowner, and somebody comes in and they want to put a marina out in front of that property. The upland owner has the preference right to take that lease and to engage in that activity. There is a second preference, and that is if we have an existing lessee, they also have a preference in terms of renewing their lease. What's not clear in our statutes is if we have an existing lessee and that lease comes to its termination expiration date. And we believe that an existing lessee who is in good standing should have that preference right to continue that operation. They've made the investment in the infrastructure. They're running a business in many cases on these lands. It's their source of income. And so the first change that you'll see in Section 1 is to extend that preference right to the existing lessee when their lease expires so that they would have the right to re-up that lease as long as they're a lessee in good standing and continue that operation. On state-owned waterways. The second change you'll notice is that there are some housekeeping changes where you'll notice that some of the places in the bill it says submersible land, some places it says submerged and submersible, some places it says submerged. And so we thought we'd take this opportunity to clean it up and clarify. This has become a point of confusion with folks who are looking at the potential for using waterways for various uses, whether things apply to the submersible lands or the submerged lands or both. And just for the committee, submersible lands are lands that are inundated between ordinary high water and low water, in a tidal area between high tide and low tide, and submerged lands are lands that are always inundated with water, so they're below the low water line or below the low tide line. And so you'll notice several places where there is cleanup on that language. Third, there's a change that would identify some uses that we can continue to authorize through a registration, but for which we would no longer require compensation. And these are structures that currently are generally registered. We charge $25 a year for a registration, so we don't get a lot of income from these, but there's a cost in processing the registrations. And so there's a list now that you'll see in Section 2 that provides a set of exemptions, and they include three kinds of activities. One is all of the structures that are behind or on lands that are currently managed by drainage districts that are organized under state statute. Most of those structures were constructed by the Corps of Engineers back in the early 1900s, and at some point those structures were turned over to drainage districts as they were formed across the state of Oregon. They include tide gates, berms, dikes, culverts, things that are intended to drain those lands or prevent those lands from flooding. And many of those are along the coastal areas and in Senator Johnson's district. So those entities would simply register those structures. They would no longer be required to pay compensation to the department for having those structures on state-owned waterways. The second structure that would be exempt from compensation would be riprap, and we have lots of riprap on rivers all across the state. We currently charge a registration fee of $25, and those would no longer be required to pay compensation. They would continue to register so we know what structures are on our lands, but they would not have to pay compensation. And then the third type of structure that would be exempt from compensation would be voluntary habitat restoration projects, and this is where the Dash 2 amendments are pretty important because they make it clear that we're really talking about voluntary projects and not projects associated with mitigation or that are done as a part of dealing with natural resource damage assessment damages associated with Superfund site cleanups. Under the statute, those landowners who are putting those structures or have those structures on lands would indemnify the state from liability. So they would assume the liability for those structures. The state would not, since we are not compensated for those. And then the last thing is this bill would allow us to, with regard to exemptions, allow us to take similar structures that may come up in the future and also exempt them from compensation. Currently, the department doesn't have the ability to exempt structures from compensation. Only the legislature could do that. So this would allow the department to do those exemptions by rulemaking and not have to come to the legislature when we want to exempt some of these structures from compensation that are similar in nature. I want to point out, when the state got these waterways at statehood, we got them for the purpose of holding them in public trust for the use of the public, for all Oregonians to enjoy, for commerce, navigation, fisheries, and recreation. So it was really about being able to use the water for the purposes that water is used for. And early on in statehood, really with a focus on navigation and commerce and the fisheries part, and recreation certainly became a public trust value as time went on. So the main purpose of these waterways is, the state owning these waterways, is really about those public trust values and not about compensation to the state for the use of those. And then the last thing this bill does, there are some statutes dealing with the harvest of kelp from submerged and submersible lands in the territorial sea. And there's been some confusion about the language associated with removal of kelp from the territorial sea, and so we've attempted in this bill to clean up that language to clarify that the amount of poundage that you can take for personal use is based on the wet poundage, not the dry poundage, and also that the use is for your own personal consumption and not for sale to others. A broad set of changes to the submerged and submersible lands. The Dash 1 amendment deals with not our with ORS 274, but with with ORS 196, which are removal fill statutes, so deals with a separate set of statutes. Still falls under the relating clause of the bill. And the Dash 1 amendment, as I read it, would increase the current 50 cubic yard exemption that's in the removal fill statutes to 100 cubic yards, and so there are a number of activities for which you can remove that amount of material annually without having to come get a permit from the Department of State Lands. And those activities are, as Senator Johnson talked about, the ditch cleaning desires, particularly in her district, but that 50 cubic yard exemption applies to all the activities under the removal fill law, not just those ditch cleaning activities. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director. Any questions for the Director? Okay. I think you seem to have answered them all. All right. So we have a couple other people who'd like to testify on this, Katie Fast and Dale Buck. And anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 600? Come up, Sue. Okay. Katie, you want to get started?
Yeah.
Or whoever. Dale, would you like to get started?
I'll start. Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau is in support of Senate Bill 600 with the Dash 1 amendments. I would add that we're also fine with the Dash 2 amendments, but are bringing forward the Dash 1s. To talk about the bill just briefly, Section 1 clarifies an exemption that the legislature previously gave irrigation equipment that goes on lands managed by the Department of State Lands, and the clarification dealt with submersible lands. However, as it was being implemented, we learned that submerged was missing. It was an important word that needed to be added in for the exemption, and that's why you're seeing those changes in the Dash 1s. It would apply to irrigation equipment that has a previous water right associated with it issued by the Water Resources Department. In Section 2, for agriculture, the important areas are actually items that serve a public good beyond just land management for farmers and ranchers, but we're looking at exemptions for tide gates and dikes that will protect a multitude of landowners, along with riprap that is going to protect waterway structures from erosion. So we're asking that those type of structures could receive an exemption from DSL for the registration fees. In the Dash 1 amendments that have been spoken to, that does increase the cubic yard exemption that's allowed to be removed without a fill and removal permit. For my membership, that's an important exemption for their ability to clean out ditches that allow water to be moved off of ground in the Tillamook area. It's critical pasture land that those cattle can get out or hay can grow. So it allows that water to be able to be flushed down the drainage ditches and keep them clean. And Dale Buck's here to talk about how this bill with the amendments will improve management of ground from a landowner's perspective.
Thank you. Dale, welcome.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Dale Buck, and I live at 25590 Chinook Street, Cloverdale. I'm a retired Tillamook dairy farmer. And let me say first off, these rules are complicated. I'm on the DSL's TAC committee for fill and removal, so I spend a fair amount of time in their office. I spend a lot of time reading. I'm an old man. I catch on slow. But we first heard about these fees back in 2009 from a public hearing in Clatsop County that they wanted to charge $750 fees for tide gates, riprap, levees, and dikes, and people have never heard of that. Now, make no mistake about it, they've been collecting some of these someplace. We just don't know about it. And recently, I've been told of some places where they have paid those fees. Tillamook County in the Oregon Solutions Project for flooding paid $445, I'm told, by the county for some side opening big tide gates that we put in to remove flood water, so they have charge. But when this got to Tillamook, tide gates have been in back in the 1900s. Many of them were put in by private landowners, and there are some core dikes in Tillamook and a lot in Clatsop County, some in the South Coast, but a lot of ours were put in by private individuals. The tide gates were put in to prevent flooding on their pasture lands when the tide comes in. And they put in low dikes to prevent salt water from intrusion into those pastures. And the riprap in Tillamook County was mostly put in the late 1950s and 1960s and the early 1970s by various government programs. And then all of a sudden now we are told they want a fee for that. So what I've included, I gave you pictures. The first pictures are riprap on Mill Creek by the Department of State Lands Office. And then on the upstream side of Mill Creek by the Historical Society is riprap that's fallen apart that needs to be repaired. And then on this next page, I give you pictures of Smith Creek in Tillamook. This creek was engineered with fish-friendly culverts on Gist Road, a little dead-end county road. And then on the cow pad, you will see where my yardstick sticking in the water. That was a fish-friendly culvert put in for cows to walk across. It's plugged. This is a January 1, 2009 flood. These pictures were taken on the 12th. On February 20th, DSL started some field trips, of which I'm very grateful for. They came on field trips in Tillamook County, Coos County, on the Coquille, Clatsop County, in the Brownsmead area, and in Clatskanie. And I really appreciate that's the first time we've ever gotten staff people out of that office to come out and talk to landowners. So on February 20th of that year, standing on that cow pad in picture one were people from ODF&W, DSL, myself, and the two farmers involved here. And they said, you got a problem here, you got to fix it. So we said, well, what do we got to do? They said, you need a restoration permit. Okay, I said, let me have the permit. The permit that they gave me is a joint permit between DSL and the Corps. It has 12 pages of instructions, how to fill out 12 pages and the permit, 2 pages to check off if the permit has been filled out properly. And believe me, no dairy farmer is going to fill this out. No little beef farmer knows how to do this. So in the end, ODF&W said, let's clean this creek out by removing the 50 yards that is now allowed that Senator Johnson was talking about and Louise Soliday. Take out the 50 yards without a permit. So in 2009, these two farmers took out the 50 yards and got the stream back in the channel. Last year, one farmer took out 50 yards again. I have asked in this amendment that be increased to 100 yards. Because 50 yards, a track hole costs from $100 to $160 an hour and a two-hour minimum. And at 50 yards, they remove that in a few minutes. And so we would get a little more economic out of it if we could remove 100 yards. And we're not going to do anything, destroy any land or anything. And I might add, in this particular creek from the cow pad where the culvert is plugged, between a quarter and three-eighths of a mile to the Nestucca River, fish died because the water went out through the pasture here, and they died from lack of oxygen in the little pools. And so it took a few days before the farmer could get in there on the ground and gather the rock back up and get the creek back in its bank. So it's just a start in the right direction. The next page is riprap with some houses in woods. Those people, when I went to them and said, are you paying $750 for an easement fee for this riprap, they thought I lost my mind. And so that would be a fee for each one of those houses. The lower picture is riprap protecting a low dike on ag land. And the next picture is low dikes protecting farmland on the Tillamook River. And when we have high water like the 96 flood of 207, that flood water goes right over the top of these dikes and right back into the river. But those low dikes were built by farmers to keep salt water out at about a 12-foot tide. The next picture is two tide gates. And when I was taking pictures of tide gates, water rivers were high and I couldn't get any good pictures. It's kind of hard to see them there, but those are a couple of tide gates. And then I included when they started this rulemaking in 2009, which Senator Johnson and Louise Soliday, they have backed off of that rulemaking now. But I included, for your information, the statement that they have to give the Secretary of State, which talks about fees and so forth. So you'll see money in there if you find all of these dikes and riprap and so forth and charge fees for them. And then on the Basque page is just a list of concerns by landowners about the department and all of this. I just put them there for you to read. And so I would ask you to support Dash 2 and Dash 1. I think it would help landowners a whole lot. And my whole goal in this, I would like to see these rules so that the average landowner can understand them. We can clean ditches, man-made ditches. The problem becomes when one of their staff people says, that's not a man-made ditch, and the farmer says it is, then we have a problem, and we've had those problems. And it's clarified a little bit better in the March 1 rules of this year. But there's just a lot of things that are not clear, and then we have a landowner ends up in court. And it's not fun, folks. It's not fun at all. And I've told Eric Mitz, who works for DSL, who I like their staff. I just don't always agree with them, that before I die, I want these rules clean. And Eric always says, well, before I retire. And they're better now than they were. Believe me, they are. But When you send field staff out, they have differences of opinion, and we there's field staff scheduled in the south end of the state right now. I'm hoping we'll get some in the north end where we can show staff what a man-made ditch is, what a little creek is that maybe has been historically a drain for land, but it plugs up and it needs to be cleaned, and then we don't want to have to pay $250 and fill out this huge permit, wait days and days, and basically you're in the in-water work period between about July 15th and September 15th, basically, when you should be doing these things short of an emergency. So a farmer has to really get everything ahead if you go through this permit process. And it would just clarify it and make it a whole lot easier. And it cuts fees. I'll grant you that. Everybody needs money now. You know that. I know that. I realize that. But it would just make it clear, and until they kick me off of the TAC committee or we do better, I will keep working with them to clarify these rules and make it easy for people to understand so we aren't in trouble in court costing them money and costing the landowner money, or else he pays a fine.
So, Dale, thank you very much for your testimony and for your public service on that committee. I know that Director Soliday was, I'm sure, taking mental notes on many of the things that you raised in your testimony. We're going to hear from Sue Marshall, then we'll take questions, so if you can hang out for a minute. I do have a senator who's waiting to testify in another bill, so I just want to make sure we get this one wrapped up, and then we'll take questions.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name's Sue Marshall. I'm here today on behalf of Tualatin Riverkeeper and Willamette Riverkeeper. We just want to speak directly to the Dash 1 and changing the threshold from 50 to 100 cubic yards. We're opposed to this change. We think it's too broadly applied. We can certainly sympathize with the complexity of the permitting process. Both of the Riverkeeper organizations are involved in restoration projects and sometimes go through these permitting processes themselves, but we think 50 cubic yard is a significant amount of fill and or removal, and to protect those beneficial public trust resources, we think it should stay the way it is. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Or I should say for these witnesses. I know you guys are not on a same panel. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks
Thank
you. For coming here today. Anybody else like to testify on Senate Bill 600? Okay, seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 600, and we will go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 946. Beth?
Senate Bill 946 would abolish the... Actually, I should say Senate Bill 946-1. You should have the amendment in the packet in front of you. Would abolish the Oregon Highland Bentgrass Commission and the Oregon Grains Commission. It would make other changes, conforming changes in the Wheat Commission statutes, authorize the Wheat Commission to adopt rules establishing per diem for commission members. It also deals with transfer of records from the commission that's being abolished to the one that's going to take over responsibility. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay, great. I think Senator Nelson is here to tell us how we can streamline government.
That's absolutely true. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, and we're just bringing this bill to abolish the two commissions. Please do not get them confused with the Oregon Wheat League or the Oregon Wheat Commission. Those are still in existence. This is just these two commissions have been out there and really are not accomplishing much at this point. So I'd turn over all the testimony to these folks next year because I've got another.
Great. Well, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League and today the Oregon Wheat Commission. I have with me Tom Dyke, who's the chair of the Oregon Wheat Commission, and he's going to explain to you the rationale behind Senate Bill 946. And then if Roger will come up, Roger Beyer, and I will discuss with you the Dash 1 amendments that you should have as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tom.
Thank you, Chairman Dingfelder and the rest of the committee members. As Janice said, my name's Tom Dyke, chairman of the Oregon Wheat Commission this year. Oregon Wheat Commission has a distinction. It was the first commodity commission that was established in the nation here, and it was the Oregon Wheat Commission here in 1947. The legislation imposes a tax to producers that assess each producer to first site of sale. Trying to do marketing research and education that was to assist all producers in the state of Oregon. Later on, the Commodity Commission followed by including the, there was an Oregon Grains Commission that was formed here in later years to do with barley, rye, triticale, canola, and mustard. It too was for doing marketing research and educational activities that they proceeded with. Production of the grain and over the last number of years is the Barley Commission has drastically reduced because of changing in markets and grower activities change. So in December, the Oregon Grains Commission have voted to disband the Oregon Grains Commission, and they would like to have it absorbed into the Oregon Wheat Commission. Presently, the Oregon Wheat Commission has enough staff to take care of that, to do the administrative work that the Grains Commission is doing. Being chairman of the Wheat Commission, why we have a lot of things in common. Most all producers that are growing wheat or growing barley too, or other grain crops. Research activity that the Wheat Commission, Grains Commission does, contracts with Oregon State University and for research activity is very similar to the same from weeds, diseases, breeding, fertility, and everything else that does that, where some of the money goes out of the commission. So it was a cost-effective deal that was discussed 3 years ago, but it finally came to thing this last year about trying to combine Wheat Commission and Grains Commission together. So I think it'll save staff and chair, because our administration presently can handle the research because we're talking with them, and the marketing things because we're doing all the same things. So I would hope for your support in that. And if you have any questions, I guess after it's over with, well, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you. Jen, did you want to add a few?
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to talk to you about the Dash 1 amendments. Mm-hmm. They do primarily two things. If you turn to page 6, they address the per diem statutes. Apparently, last session, the per diem statutes were updated for some of the commissions, but the Wheat Commission sits out in a different section of statute. So this addresses that fix for the Oregon Wheat Commission. And then Roger can talk about his request in this Dash 1 as well.
Great, thank you. Yes, I noticed bent grass and fescue, which last I looked, they weren't grains, is in the commission, or in this commission bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, here representing the Oregon Seed Council. Two of the five commissions that are for the grass seed industry are the Fine Fescue Commission and the Highland Bent Grass Commission. The Highland Bent Grass Commission is a very specialized crop that the acreage has been dwindling in the past few years, and Brian Ostland is here. He's administrator of both of these commissions, and he has a chart to give you that demonstrate what I'm saying when the production is dwindling to the point that the Highland Bent Grass Commission no longer can really afford to do anything. The commission is important in that there's a European registration where most of the Highland bent grass that is grown is sold into the European market. That European registration has to be updated every 10 years in order to keep that market alive. So the commission is needed for that purpose, but at this point in time, with administrative costs, there's no money left really to pay for anything and be able to do that registration. So the hope is that by combining with the Fine Fescue Commission, much like you heard about in the Wheat Commission, they have staff there that can take on the administrative functions of that, and hopefully without additional costs, be able to save enough money to keep this European registration alive and a market for the Highland bent grass. With that, if you have any technical questions, specific questions, I will turn this microphone over to Brian Ostland, who will be able to answer them instead of just talk about them. So with that, Madam Chair, that's my testimony.
Okay. Thank you. I did want to check with Senator Brzozinski, since he worked on the Pillbury bill last year, and see if there are any.
We've already talked, and it looks like it's a great way to help out the commissions and those different organizations that aren't able to do it themselves, so I'm fully supportive.
Okay. Great. Would you like, do we need to have Brian to come up to answer any questions? Anybody have any questions regarding these changes? Okay.
Thank you
for bringing us an efficiency bill.
Exactly.
It only took 3 years. You know, government works in amazing ways. Anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 946? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 946. I will open up a work session on 946. Would you like to make a motion?
No, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 946.
Dash ones.
As amended
dash
by
one.
The...
Oh,
first
dash,
you first have to hear. We'll give you a script.
Give me the script. We got an amendment.
Yeah.
Chair Dingfelder, I move to adopt the Senate Bill 946-1 amendment stated 310-11.
Okay. Senator Olson moves the dash one amendments dated 310-11. These have been around a while. With a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Now,
Chair Dinkfelder, I move Senate Bill 946 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 946 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, motion carries. And I was going to see if Senator Nelson would like to carry this bill since it's his bill. And we can have Senator Olson as a backup, just in case. What's that? Okay. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 946. Because we're going to lose some members, I think we are going to do our other work session first. So we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 119, and I will. We don't have any amendments on that, correct?
Okay.
So I will take a motion on Senate Bill 119.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 119 without recommendation as passage to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Przanski moves Senate Bill 119 without recommendation as to passage to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? You're looking perplexed about this.
Full Ways and Means? Full?
It'll have to, yes, it'll go to full. Mm-hmm. That's your committee.
They got to sit there and play with it.
Yeah. Any discussion? Any questions? Okay, seeing none, why don't we have the clerk call the roll for this one? We'll make sure you guys are awake.
Senator
Happ? Aye.
Senator
Thompson?
Aye.
Senator
Olson?
Aye.
Senator Aye. With that, the motion carries. We won't assign a carrier because that will go down to Ways and Means. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 119. And we have two bills up for a public hearing still. So we'll go ahead and open Senate Bill 849 first, and Beth, if you can provide us with a summary.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 849 authorizes forest protective associations to request a hearing with the Board of Forestry if the association asserts that an action and approved budget for the district may affect the adequacy of fire prevention and suppression services. There is a dash one amendment in the packet in front of you. There was no revenue impact in the original bill, and we do not have a fiscal impact statement on either the original or the dash one.
Okay, and Senator Berger had introduced this bill, so Josh, you want to come up and provide us with some information, and then we'll call the, let's see, who else we'll call up after that. Does the agency want to come up?
Yes.
ODF?
So,
yes.
Paul,
do you want to come up as well?
Here to answer questions. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, why don't you come up and keep Josh company in case there's some questions?
I need some companies.
Lifelines are coming.
Yes. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Josh Savvy, policy advisor to Senator Verger. Senator Verger is very sorry that she could not personally attend today, so I will do my best to give you some background about this bill. I'm going to be referencing a letter I think you should have received from Senator Verger in your packet.
It's in our packet.
Okay. Oregon's collective success in fire protection can be traced to 100 years of collaboration and local preparedness, matching local risks through 12 local forest protective associations. Landowners are responsible for providing an adequate level of fire protection in statute. They arrive at this level with our district personnel annually in good faith deliberations and trust. Upon submitting these budgets to a board of forestry, the board is tasked with determining and improving whether a collective adequate level of fire protection exists for landowners and for Oregon. The funds for this adequate level of suppression are shared. The per-acre assessment rates for private lands are matched 50-50 with general funds. When fire exceeds the capacity and complexity of local resources, costs for these emergency situations up to $10 million currently come from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, whose revenues are 100% from fees and assessments with no general fund impact. There is no sharing of the value of the resources lost to wildlife, to wildfires. These losses are entirely on the shoulders of the landowners, as adequate protection is their only insurance against loss. Above the $10 million, the next $15 million come from the general fund, for a total of $25 million towards an insurance deductible. Past the adequate level of suppression and insurance deductible, Oregon then reaches into $25 million into the $25 million insurance policy. In the very unlikely event, and we hope very unlikely, the general fund would assume the funding. This system of insurance coverage was designed to minimize the impact on the general fund for fire protection services and has been very successful as long as the commitments are honored. Due to the interdependent linking of sharing costs for every $1 reduction in general funds, the resulting reduction in service at the field level is $3. The need for SB 849 stems from the continued budget reductions in any form. When the state reduces the 50% obligation for adequate level of suppression or allotment reductions, the State Board of Forestry is required to determine whether an adequate level still exists. Should the board still determine an adequate level exists, SB 849 would allow a continuation of the existing insurance deductible. If the board agrees reductions have eroded the adequacy of protection levels locally or collectively, the initial liability for the insurance deductible would be reversed in the event of a fire season, which would require additional protections. This is under the Dash 1 amendment. If the state is willing to assume the risk of reducing an adequate level of suppression, the state should assume the initial financial risk for additional services. That's essentially the current system, and what we hope to change. And our goal here is just to create an appeals process that we believe is fair. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Josh. I would like to hear from the department, and I'd like to hear your views on this. And then one question that came up for me, since the department determines what's adequate, would the department determine what's inadequate? Since in this bill we're now defining inadequate. I mean, the trigger for that was a question that I had.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Paul Bell, Associate State Forester and Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. Maybe you could restate that.
Well, under Section 3, if you look at the dash ones, sub A, I wanted to see if you had any comments on that, on how we're defining inadequate in there.
Chair Dingfelder, first, this isn't language from the Department of Forestry, so... but I do, you know, I believe what it is trying to say is when, for a reason, say like allotment reduction last year, the department is forced to reduce the budget for fire protection, that at a certain level, then where we had a budget for adequate level of protection, then the funding becomes reduced. Would have an inadequate level of protection in place.
Well, yeah, that to me, it's just sort of amorphous, this part of it, as far as the who determines what's inadequate. So maybe I'll have the director come up. I don't know if there's been any comments from the Board of Forestry on this.
Chair Dingfelder, not to my knowledge.
Okay. All right. That was the question I had. Other questions for the department?
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Who else do we have going to testify?
Christina McNitt, OFIC, and Roger Beyer.
All right. And I'm wondering if there's a lot of people in the room that have an interest in this. I'd like to kind of, I have not heard from anyone on this as to their perspective.
Okay. All right. Why don't we, you guys hang out in case there's questions? That would be helpful. We'll have Christina McNitt and Roger Beyer come up, and that's all who's signed up on this. Anybody else would like to testify? All the people in the back are just hanging out to see what the questions are.
Lock the doors. We may need to have them here for the lifelines.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Would like to express appreciation to Senator Verger for her efforts on this bill and to express some regret, Senator Prozanski, you haven't heard about these Dash 1 amendments because I did a shoddy job of actually getting around to all of your offices before this hearing. You'll see the amendments were dated on the 31st, and we gave it a shot, but we fell short. So I will try to walk you through them today. In Senator Verger's written statement, there was a good summary provided about how the Department of Forestry's fire protection program currently works, how it's paid for, and how the program would be modified by this bill. But my purpose here is to give you the background about why the forest landowners have brought the proposal to you at this time. Last June, you will recall as well as anyone, the governor ordered across-the-board allotment reductions for all state agencies. They needed to rebalance the 09-11 budget, and this did include reductions to the Department of Forestry's fire program. Coincidentally, the governor's order coincided with the Board of Forestry's annual obligation by statute to determine at its June meeting whether or not the state, through budgets submitted by the 12 local fire protection districts and matching funds provided by the state, is adequately prepared for fire. The general fund allotment reduction in the fire program caused alarm bells to go off in the forest protection districts across the state. Because of the way landowner and other matching funds are assessed and applied to this program, the overall effect of the governor's order was to reduce the fire program budget by approximately $4 million on the eve of fire season. For the first time in memory, the board's decision as to whether or not an adequate level of protection was in place turned out not on the landowner's share of this responsibility, but on the state's share instead. Landowners testified before the Board of Forestry in June, said that the state could simply not afford a $4 million hit to the program. And that it would not be adequately prepared to fight fires. Landowners also attempted to place this matter before the June Emergency Board to request a restoration of those general fund dollars that had been removed from the fire program. Despite significant support among E-Board legislative members and in the governor's office, the Department of Forestry chose instead not to pursue that option. Despite landowner testimony, the board in June certified the fire program budget as adequate. That decision was largely based on speculation that because the state was experiencing a quote-unquote wet spring, the 2010 fire season would be less likely to be severe, and therefore the level of protection was probably adequate despite the $4 million hole. Luckily, the board was right. They won that bet, and the state did experience a mild 2010 fire season, but it was a risky proposition nonetheless, since a wet spring does not necessarily portend a mild fire season. And the state was gambling not with their funds, but primarily with landowner assets. The risk of loss of those assets, which we consider as standing timber, mostly on private land, is totally uninsurable. Our only insurance is an adequate level of fire protection. So the landowner's real stake in the program is not only their share of the cost of fire suppression, but also those values at risk of catastrophic forest fires. LFO, just before the session, produced a report that said of the 16 million acres that the Department of Forestry protects, it has a current estimated value at risk of $60 billion with a B dollars. So that's the background of what prompted the landowners to ask Senator Verger to introduce this bill. Its real purpose is to provide a financial incentive for the state through the Board of Forestry to never again certify as adequate a fire program budget that has been precipitously reduced on the eve of fire season. It does so by shifting the liability for the first $10 million in emergency fire costs, which are currently wholly paid by landowners, from the landowners to the state. And you can see that in the Dash 1 Amendment, Section 3, Sub 2. And if you'd like me to walk through those amendments, I'd be happy to do so, or let Roger testify and then answer questions.
I'm going to let Roger testify, and then we'll answer any questions.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here as a somewhat of a dual role. I represent the Oregon Small Woodlands Association as their contract lobbyist. But also, I guess maybe a triple role, I am a private forest land owner in the Clackamas-Marion Forest Patrol Association. I'm also on the board of directors of that association, and just earlier today was elected president of that association. So,
congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. It's you get the same pay.
Similar to us.
Yeah, exactly. I've been on the association board in Clackamas-Marion with the exception of a one-year sabbatical since 1983, so I have a little bit of history in this part of the forest world. The associations last year were astonished when we found out that after we had gone through, I mean, and it's literally dozens of meetings and going over the district budgets with a fine-tooth comb and with much angst last year, because we all knew the funding level and what was going on at the state budget. Each district certifies its own level of protection, and then when the Board of Forestry was, reduced that level, but still said it was adequate, we were quite upset at the district level. We were probably more upset when we found that there was nothing we could do about it. There was no process of appeal. We had always thought we were in a partnership with the Department of Forestry on protecting our own lands, but it turned out the partnership was kind of a one-way deal. They relied on us to help fund it, but if they chose to change their minds at the government level on what was adequate, we had nothing to say about it. So it's under that backdrop that we have this bill in front of us, and the bill as drafted seeks to deal with that part of it, the appeal process, so at least landowners would have a voice in the process. The Dash 1 amendments are another important step in that process, in that, as you heard from Christina, it's our lands, it's our assets that are at risk. Granted, the state budget also protects BLM land in western Oregon and also the state forests in western Oregon, but it's primarily the private landowners' lands that are at risk. And when this happens, we feel that we should no longer carry the burden of paying for that if we know that it's not adequate. So I heard your questions earlier to the Department of Forestry, Madam Chair, about who's going to define what is inadequate. And under current law, the districts all work together with the landowners to provide or to come up what they consider as adequate. So I guess anything less than that would be, by default, inadequate. And that's how I read this, the Dash 1 amendments. The amendments still need work. I think the language is still being worked on in certain areas, but we wholly support this, both as the association, as the private forest land owner, and the small woodlands owners. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions for either Christina or Roger? Looks like Senator Prasansky does.
Yeah, I guess one question. Roger, you said there's more amendments. Can you kind of give us a guide of where you're looking at? Because I'd like to absorb this and maybe talk to some of the members just to see... make sure we have the checks and balances in from both perspectives.
That's the first that I heard that there were more amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Prasansky, under Section 3A, there is some wordsmithing there, like the word emergency probably isn't the best word under on line 7, maybe preparedness or maybe readiness or something like that. On line 9, we need to... Where it reads currently creates a level of risk to firefighters, looking at maybe adding the word higher in front of level. In line 12, I'm trying to make sure I can read the writing here. Instead, the word standard is there, and adequate level rather than standard. Again, down in line 18, where you have aggregated budgets, replacing that with something to the effect of prorated share of private lands per acre assessment. So that's lines 12 through 15 on the second page of the amendments. Don't know if that's needed in the bill or in the amendment. It may be easier to get someone else who's, but that's, those are the, there's a couple other wordsmith things on the second page that I'm trying to read the writing very, very quickly.
Madam Chair and members, it's just been kind of complicated to, the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund is private landowner funds that are aggregated from six different revenue streams. So the concept, I think, is embodied here. We're just trying to wordsmith it and make sure that
gotcha.
It flows the way we intended it to flow, which basically is if the Board of Forestry is willing to gamble on certifying something as adequate that the 12 forest protection associations don't necessarily agree as adequate. First thing is we want an appeals process for districts. Right now there's only an appeals process for individuals. And the second thing is if you're going to gamble on that adequate level of protection, gamble on, frankly, your own money, not on, we're already gambling with our trees, but we would prefer that first $10 million to come from the state rather than the Forest Land Protection Fund.
Okay, any other questions? All right, well, it sounds like this still needs some work, and I'm sure that we'll be following up on this. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill?
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 849. We have one more public hearing on forestry issues, Senate Bill 862. Is that right number?
Yep.
Yes. And we only have Doug Decker signed up right now. This is another bill that Senator Verger worked on. Is that correct? Do you want to come up and say a few words?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Be even shorter this time. For the record, again, my name is Josh Savvy, a policy advisor to Senator Verger. We consider this bill almost as cleanup. There's some uncertainty about whether or not the department can contract for certain biomass projects, and our bill is just to add clarity in that the Department of Forestry can contract for the sale of biomass. And to create an inventory of what's currently available. You have a dash one amendment in front of you, and we already recognize that there is a couple word issues, mainly around non-compete, I think. It's in section one, if I remember.
Line seven, page one.
Yeah, page one, line seven. We'd like to delete that, but everything else in the dash one amendment is where we're at. So if you have any questions, but I think the state forester has a very detailed testimony that he can provide.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Decker, state forester, director of the Department of Forestry. I appreciate the opportunity to touch base on some of these amendments here on Senate Bill 862. I want to just touch on the objectives that are addressed by the Dash 1 amendments. Senate Bill 862 revisits some important issues regarding forest health and biomass that were taken up in the 2005 legislature, and its strong bipartisan passage of Senate Bill 1072. So there's several things here, and I won't go into detail. You have my testimony in front of you. But first I would say, you know, one of the objectives that the Dash 1 amendments tries to address is to explicitly reference the authority that we have at the department to enter into contracts for the purpose of providing a supply of woody biomass necessary to facilitate the development of bioenergy projects. And so we are specifically recommending, as Josh has just mentioned, deletion of the words negotiated non-competitive from page one of line seven of the Dash 1 amendments. So first objective, again, dealing with our contracting authority on biomass, woody biomass projects. The second is to amend a minor amendment to the Forest Practices Act that makes a very explicit reference to the commercial removal of woody biomass as a forest practice regulated by the Act. There is, as you know, there's an increased interest in woody biomass utilization, and the text here highlights woody biomass removal as a regulated forest practice, along with the traditional forest practices. The third objective that the bill tries to address is directing us at the Department of Forestry to conduct an assessment of the types of woody biomass that are available. The assessment that's described in the Dash 1 amendments would be a coarser scale of biomass availability. It could be accomplished with a lower fiscal impact to our agency. The fourth objective is to modify the current requirement that we produce a report to the legislature every 3 years. We did one in 2008. We're working on one in 2011, but the Dash 1 amendments give us a greater discretion on the need for and the timing associated with future updates. And then the last objective that the Dash 1 amendments addresses is to clean up some of the language that describes woody biomass, that makes it clear, that clarifies that the term does not include wood that has been treated with a variety of different chemicals. So we believe that the Dash 1 amendments, with the modification that we've described here, will help us to get to a place where we can better utilize woody biomass, both for bioenergy and for forest health purposes as well.
Okay, questions for State Forester or for Josh? I actually have a question. I just have to find the reference here regarding the survey. It is in section regarding doing an assessment of woody biomass. Is this a statewide assessment? Is it on state lands? Is it on private lands? Is it on BLM, USDA lands? What's the scope of that assessment?
Madam Chair, I actually don't know what the scope of that assessment is. I believe that it is on all lands, but I will follow up with you.
Okay. Well, a follow-up question is, do you have that information readily available? Is that going to require reporting then by private landowners, or is that something that they would include in as part of their Forest Practices Act reporting? You know, I'm just curious if this is going to be a whole new set of reports and if this is going to cause a fiscal for the agency,
right,
given that we are trying to figure out how to fund your agency as it is.
Right. So I don't know the answer to that question about the methodology of that report, but I will find that out and I will share that back. My sense is, our intention is not to create any additional data gathering. I know that we have several biomass. We have one lead biomass person whose role is to facilitate biomass operations at the local level. I believe that that person is a leader on putting this report together, and I think that's, it's his task as opposed to something that's mainstreamed into other data gathering systems. But I will follow up on that.
Yeah, the language on lines 17 through 26 is very amorphous.
Yep.
And I see that we changed it from every 3 years to periodically.
That was the idea, was to kind of get out of, to add a little bit of flexibility for the timing of when we have to do that.
Okay. All right. And I'm assuming that you don't have current authority to enter into these contracts, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Is that correct?
Well, we do actually have we do have authority to enter into contracts. I think the initial impetus for this legislation came out of the idea of having longer-term contracts. Folks who are looking at investing in biomass facilities to capitalize, they need a long-term supply of material. And so typically our timber sale contracts and all of those processes are set up on a three-year basis. And so the notion was to look at ways in which we could extend the contract time period to allow a developer to have a stable supply of material upon which they would be able to capitalize the facility. So this just would assist with that.
Okay, and do you have any, since I've been fairly involved with the federal contracts in the past, and I know that we've been trying to work with the federal government to get longer-term contracts, 10 to 20-year contracts on our federal forests, are you optimistic that this will help in that process, or does that influence the process with the federal forests at all?
In terms of, so this is specifically related to state forest lands,
okay.
And so, I do believe, particularly on some of the lands that we own in eastern Oregon, that this going to a longer supply agreement can make it a little bit easier for developers who are looking at projects. I don't believe that this actually speaks to federal forest issues.
Well, and I understand that and appreciate that, but since our state forest land is only 3% of our forest land, it's still a pretty small supply for looking at longer-term contracts.
Here, here. And we actually cooperate closely with the Forest Service on looking at ways that we can assist with them in the stewardship way, stewardship agreements and contracts to help them carry out work that is similar to this on federal land.
Okay. All right. Yes, Senator Thompson.
I just had a quick question. So
sure.
Could you just kind of briefly tell me the problems that this will solve? Just one more time.
I think, well, there's a couple of things. I think it gives us a little bit more flexibility in terms of our reporting requirements. It also, and the assessment that we do, I think it also allows us, the first part that has to do with contract agreements, gives us an ability to have a longer window in terms of our timber sale contracts with purchasers of woody biomass material.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Assistant Town Center has. Okay. Anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 862. With that, Beth, any announcements? Oh, yes. Thank you. Good thing. This is why you're here, is to make sure the chair doesn't forget this. Before we adjourn, I just want to remind committee members that I sent out, actually Melanie sent out on my behalf an email about the tax credit bills, which will be coming up for our work session soon. And if you have any comments, questions, or thoughts on those, I would like to hear from you soon. I think we said by end of day Wednesday in that email, because we will have to schedule those. So I've sent out memo, would appreciate any feedback on that. And with that, we are adjourned.